This week on Behind the Lens.
We really want to make sure that given all of our student mobility, no matter where they transfer, that process of credit accumulation is actually standardized and systematized within our system.
Orleans school officials ordered new record-keeping standards for high schools following problems at John F. Kennedy High. Montejuicin wraps a busy week in education news. Michael Isaacstein reports on a responsible bidders ordinance being considered at council. And what's Plan B in the face of climate disruption? We'll hear from the authors of a new op-ed on planning for the worst. I'm Tom Wright. You're listening to Behind the Lens, brought to you by Community Support. Show your support today at thelensnoaa.org/donate. The Orleans Parish School District has ordered changes for all of its high schools in their record-keeping practices. Standardized and systematized are the key words in this initiative. District Accountability Officer Kelly Peterson discussed these changes at a meeting Tuesday evening.
I think it's important to note that one of the things that we did in this year one, it was important for us to make sure that we, again, understood the landscape. And so we held the bar very high related to ensuring with schools what is compliant. And that meant that all of these files must have been compliant.
Peterson also talked about audits that have been completed at all high schools. Lens reporter Marta Juson has details.
On a story you've been following for quite some time, troubles at John F. Kennedy High School, there was an audit released Monday.
That audit found a number of financial issues, but what I think we found most interesting in that audit was that New Beginnings had potentially enrolled students who didn't have proper documentation. That is an issue potentially because funding is tied to individual students, and so if they don't live in the proper parish where they say they are going, that could be sending money essentially in the wrong direction. Right, so what I found to be particularly interesting about this issue is that we are looking at, in terms of residency, how students prove that they indeed live in Orleans Parish. And what we learned is we spoke to the former head of the Recovery School District in New Orleans Enrollment Center. And, you know, she was talking to us about how she thinks schools generally do a very good job of collecting residency information when they enroll students the first time or the first year that they enter the school. But she thinks that on a year-to-year basis, that is more of a challenge for schools. I mean, you know, they're already bogged down with collecting so much paperwork anyways that this is one more thing that they're potentially having to collect from every single student. And it's not necessarily easy to prove your residency depending on your housing status or a number of other things.
In not an unrelated report that you did later in the week, the NOLA Public School District outlined plans for some standardization steps in terms of record keeping for high schools.
Right. And so that's also born out of the graduation scandal that occurred at Kennedy last year, where nearly half the class found out after graduation that they hadn't been given the proper coursework to graduate. What the district is doing now is it's audited all its high schools, and they've come back and they've said, look, this is the paperwork that we want to see you collecting for every single student. They use the word standardize and systematize. These are things that the district wants to do to make it easier for kids to move from school to school, if that should happen, but also for any employees that are moving from school to school to know and have this kind of consistent knowledge of, you know, these are the documents we need to be seeing for children to ensure that they are meeting graduation eligibility requirements. All the schools are independent charters, and they have their own record-keeping systems and their own handbooks and their own, some of these schools keep these records in paper files. Others use online forms. So there's just a variety of different styles of record-keeping out there, and the district just wants to ensure that students, have access to that information at any point in their high school careers, and that information is being properly recorded.
Your latest reporting on the Lens is this suit that the school district now finds itself facing.
The charter group that runs Mary Coghill Charter School in Gentilly Woods has filed a lawsuit against the Orleans Parish School Board and Superintendent Henderson Lewis. They're alleging that the superintendent has usurped the board and gone above their heads by proceeding to take over this charter school, which the district is planning to run next year. And this all kind of stems out of an announcement that was made in November that Lewis was going to take away the charter at the end of the year, school year, and then B, a vote in December where the Orleans Parish School Board brought forward a motion to overturn Lewis's recommendation, which they're allowed to do up to a month after his recommendations are made to the board. And at that meeting, they voted 4-2 to overturn him, but state law and policy requires a 2/3 vote of the, quote, full membership of the board. The charter is arguing that because they got 4-2 vote, that was 2/3 of the members who were present. The district, however, says that that's a flawed argument and that it was not 2/3 of the total number of board members.
Okay.
So one member was absent.
What are the plaintiffs calling for in this suit?
They want the district and the superintendent to be enjoined and basically be stopped from taking over the school. And they want to be able to allow to continue to run the school. We've never actually seen that vote get brought forward to the board before because the Orleans Parish superintendent has a lot of unique power that was given to that office by Act 91, which was the law that was passed to bring all the charter schools back from the Recovery School District to the Orleans Parish School Board. He has a lot of unique power and authority. So this is the first time we've really seen this be tested. And, you know, I'm looking forward to hearing some of these arguments in court. I think it's going to be very interesting. So
very good. Marta Jusen covering the week in education. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
New Orleans Mayor and City Council have begun work on a potential responsible bidders ordinance. Michael Isaacstein covered that story and more in City Politics.
The ordinance is something that there's kind of been this renewed public call for in the wake of the Hard Rock collapse in October. And responsible bidders ordinance, it's still a little undefined right now as to the specifics of what it would include, but the general idea is to push the city when it's considering new contracts who to hire, that along with price, there should also be considerations and transparency when it comes to how they treat their workers and how seriously they take safety standards.
What would they look at in terms of safety records? I mean, violations? What would be reviewed in a case like that?
So like you said, any past, you know, violations of worker safety standards would be a big one. You know, but I think there was also a really big focus, at least at the meeting, on this issue of employee misclassification, which according to the speakers on at that meeting, which included a lot of union representatives in the construction business, that this is a large issue. And basically what that means is, you know, we're basically talking about tax forms here. So when you have an employee, are you properly classifying them as a W-2 employee, or are you classifying them as independent contractors with a 1099? And that has a significant difference in terms of how employees are treated, but also in terms of how much a company needs to pay for employee costs. So when you're not classified as an employee, as an independent contractor, a company doesn't have to provide certain benefits. They don't have to provide overtime compensation, family and medical leave. They don't need to pay into an unemployment insurance trust fund that the state has. And there was a study that was referenced multiple times during the meeting, a Michigan State University study from 2008 that said that construction contractors can save anywhere from 20-40% on labor costs by misclassifying their employees. So one thing, you know, we were talking about disclosure. They were saying that this would help because, okay, if a company comes and says, you know, we want this construction contract, but you look and see, okay, well, they have 2 full-time employees doing administrative work and then 40 independent contractors, right? That could be a red flag that, okay, you know, they're just misclassifying the actual construction workers, which means that those workers aren't going to have all these necessary benefits that they should have.
What is the next step for this particular ordinance?
it?
Yeah, so the next step is actually writing the ordinance. Right now, it's more of an idea with general goals and aspects, but there's not actually anything on paper. Councilwoman Cindy Nguyen said that they're going to try and have a draft together on this in the next 2 months. That they're working with Mayor Cantrell's administration. And I should note that at the meeting, the three other council members that were there, they also said that they were supportive of this. So it actually looks likely that this is, at least going to come up for, debate.
Another story you were following this week, the board of the New Orleans Tourism Marketing Corporation voting to essentially completely change its organizational mission this week at a meeting on Monday.
Yeah, so it might be helpful to kind of start with the background on this. New Orleans Tourism Marketing Corporation is, for years it's been a publicly funded, basically a marketing agency for the city that was mostly focused on bringing, visitors from outside the state to New Orleans. But that kind of changed last year with Mayor LaToya Cantrell's Fair Share deal. So, if you'll recall, that was her attempt to negotiate with the tourism industry as well as state government officials to try and get some more hotel taxes and tourism, tax revenue directed towards municipal projects, specifically infrastructure projects, and even more specifically, infrastructure projects at the Sewerage and Water Board. Now, this deal had a lot of different components, but it included a bunch of different trade-offs between the hospitality industry and the city, but one of them was the merger of New Orleans Tourism Marketing Corporation and New Orleans and Company, which is another publicly funded marketing agency for the city. So basically what's happening right now is that the majority of the funding and the mission of New Orleans Tourism Marketing Corporation is being transferred over to New Orleans and Co. Now, New Orleans Tourism and Marketing Corporation is going to have a small budget left over, about $3.9 million, compared to what they were having last year, which was around $16 million. Now, the vote that I covered was basically about what comes next and what they're going to do with this remaining smaller budget. A merger between these two bodies has been in discussion for a long time, but there was always a question about whether the merger should leave the organization with New Orleans and Company, which is a private nonprofit, or whether it should go with the New Orleans Tourism and Marketing Corporation, which is a public body, that has all the accountability and transparency that comes with a public body. Now, the tourism industry kind of won out in this regard because the merger, sent that money to the private nonprofit where it can kind of be spent a little more freely without, the same reporting requirements or accountability to the city council. It would basically, change from a marketing company to a fund to give grants to, what is being described as cultural institutions and the city's culture bearers. And what exactly that means is still largely undefined. Basically all they've voted to do so far is to change their mission statement. So instead of marketing to outside tourists, it is supporting culture bearers in the city. Exactly how those decisions will be made, who will be eligible for a grant or funding is still unclear. There are some people who, have kind of criticized this, feeling a little uncomfortable that there's going to be all this money being handed out and that we don't yet have a clear, rubric for who will get it. But I think, it was pointed out that there are still a lot more steps before the money actually starts being handed out. This has to be passed by the city council. Then they're going to have to appoint a new board for this new fund, which will then have open meetings and on and on and on. So there's still a lot more, that we're going to have to follow before we know exactly where this money is going to go.
Michael Isaacstein reporting for The Lens. Thank you, Carolyn.
Thank you.
Back in the 1980s, in Section G of the New Orleans Criminal District Court, everybody smoked. Section G was Judge Frank Shea's courtroom, and when you talk to lawyers who practiced in front of him during that time, or defendants who were sentenced by him, it's one of the first things they will tell you.
So it wasn't unusual when you opened the door to the courtroom. It was like, I mean, it was worse than a bar room, okay?
Today, of course, it is acknowledged that smoking's bad for you. But back then, everyone was doing it. From The Lens, this is the Section G podcast, looking back at the controversial career of Judge Frank Shea and the New Orleans Criminal District Court during the rise of mass incarceration.
Nick Krastel presents Section G in print and on podcast, coming soon at thelensnola.org. When the planning community talks about how to respond to climate change, much of their focus turns to resilience, but another word beginning with R, retreat, is the subject of a new opinion piece. It's written from a planner's perspective and will be published in coming days by the Washington Post. The authors, Stephen Mingler and Martin Peterson, offer a preview for Behind the Lens.
I think there are a lot of people who are out there who have an interest in being overly optimistic. And I think there are a lot of people out there who have an interest in being overly pessimistic. And I actually think that what we're writing is fairly realistic. I know that, and if there is fear in it, it's probably because we've all been through it after Hurricane Katrina. And we kind of know what it looks like and feels like. And if you haven't been through it, like everybody else, except I guess maybe the folks in Houston and some folks in North Carolina, it's easy to dismiss it. So, and I will say, I believe it's urgent. And the reason why I believe it's urgent is because it takes a long time to plan for, to plan for resettlement of tens of millions of people.
I just think you have to look at the maps and then chart sea level rise and then see where the population is. It's, we're congregated on coasts. Mm-hmm. And so it's inevitable that certain cities are going to be defendable and certain cities will not be defendable. And we should be planning for that contingency, hoping and praying that we don't need to do that. But we should be ready with plans because there's a very good chance that we might have to engage in the mass relocating of American citizens. It's, and we're not just talking about American. This is a global issue.
Right. And this is not just our opinion. I mean, the fact of the matter is that the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration is predicting that the low sea level rise will be by 2100. Will be around 2 feet, and the moderate will be somewhere around 4 feet, and the high will be somewhere around 8.5 feet. And then they have a caveat to that that says, if there are things that happen to the ice sheets that they don't know about yet, then all bets are off.
And so, the ice sheets are melting at a rapid pace that is alarming scientists.
And I think another thing that Martin and I have talked about is that it seems like every time we get more news, it's not better news. It's not getting any better. The science is not predicting any lower every time it goes a little higher. And if that trend continues, then it's time for, as I say, for Paul Revere to ride. And it's time to spread the alarm to every Middlesex village and farm that the oceans are rising, and they're rising faster than they've ever risen. And 70% of our population lives, you know, within a couple hundred miles of the ocean. And imagine what it takes to relocate all of that infrastructure.
Even those of us who actively are fighting the fight, everybody is engaged in some level of climate denialism. Stephen and I are intimately involved in the architecture and design world and the planning world. And the buzzword of the last 5 years was resilient design. And that is in the assumption that we can design our way out of the problem. And honestly, if we continue to go along that path without thinking about Plan B, we are also engaging in a kind of denial. We have to face the facts as they are.
And I want to say that we are all hopeful.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, great. Let's keep going with Plan A. I mean, I drive a Tesla. Okay, so I'm happy to see what's happening, you know, in the automotive industry, for example. At least the market forces are moving in the right direction. I think that the reason why we say we have to have Plan B is just in case Plan A doesn't work, it's always a good idea to have a backup plan. And now would be the time to start planning for that backup plan and see what it looks like. It's not to say, let's go move millions of people. But it's let's get prepared just in case we need to move millions of people.
We worry about tomorrow, and we worry about taking our kids to school, and we worry about walking the dog, and we get tied up in our lives and don't think that far ahead. And collectively, we definitely don't. And we're coming up on a doozy of a planning challenge, unprecedented in the history of the planet.
Right. And I will say, as a planner, it's heartbreaking to write those words. It's heartbreaking to imagine that we have to be looking at this point as another alternative that has high consequences. So, but on the other hand, I like to say planning is always a good thing. It's even better when you do it ahead of time.
Well, there's the planned way, and then there's the unplanned way. The unplanned way will be chaos. It'll be it'll be science fiction horror. The planned way will be really, really difficult. The unplanned way will be unthinkable. But at the same time, America has open land, but we can't use it all because some of it we have to keep for farming. But we have cities that have emptied out that could be repopulated. I mean, it's not unthinkable and it's not undoable. But if it is doable for our children and our grandchildren and generations, then the time to start those plans, however dire they seem, is now.
And I also, it's fraught with all kinds of uncertainties because it's one thing to talk about sea level rise, but we also need to talk about wildfires. We also need to talk about drought because this ecosystem doesn't behave in a linear sequential way, right? Nobody knows exactly what's going to happen. There are some projections that even as the coasts are being consumed by the ocean, that the Midwest will be consumed by drought. And it's just as difficult to plan for too much water as it is to plan for not enough water. So where are you going to go to? And at the end of the day, how much acreage is left? So some of the things that would be logical, I think, to think about is that probably means higher density wherever it is.
But even the Iowa town that was once 5,000 and is now 2,000 might be 15,000. I mean, like those are the things you would have to do. You would have to do maps and density overlays, and you'd really have to think it out. But
in fact, you know, what Martin just pointed out is probably the least disruptive solution. The most disruptive solution would be, say, let's take the Virginia coast of Norfolk and Virginia Beach and just move it to Richmond, which is actually one of the scenarios that has been projected, that the coast of the Atlantic Ocean will end up in Richmond, Virginia. Well, that means all of those people have to move, I guess, into the Shenandoah Valley somehow, some way, or further inland, maybe, I guess, as far as West Virginia or wherever. But it also means that there's a toxic soup that's left over. The infrastructure that we've built that becomes inundated with seawater is going to be full of oil and gas and lots of things that are currently buried in that area. So there are both issues involved in the so-called sending sites, which the sites where people would be leaving from, be sent from, and the receiving sites where people would be going to. So the notion of building what's called megalopolis, right? The whole East Coast is one big long city, if you don't mind. The idea of moving that 200 miles inland is pretty wild thing to think about. But easier to think about is a more sort of distributed system where you just go to these thousands of towns and villages and just grow each one of them a little bit instead of trying to move the wall all at once.
I mean, you can make a real good argument now that climate change is no longer a technical problem. It's a political problem, because we could shift to renewables in 10 or 15 years. The technology is there to do it. What there isn't is the political will to do it. So I would say it's a more of a political challenge now than it is a technical challenge. I think 20 years ago, renewables weren't a possibility. They couldn't even begin to make up the difference between fossil fuels. But now they can. But their implementation is blocked by political and financial roadblocks.
But I will say that on the positive side, that government. Governor Cuomo in New York just announced today a $275 billion infrastructure program. And a big chunk of that infrastructure program is aimed at resilience. Good. That's a good step. And that's the government, stepping in and doing the right thing. And even the federal government is, through FEMA, is plowing, hundreds of millions of dollars into Houston, and actually there's a program. It's not called climate change. I think it's called natural disaster relief. So call it what you will. Good. I mean, these are steps in the right direction. And we need to applaud all those steps that are going in the right direction, aimed at resilience. And so it with all of that input, the situation might be less bad. Our question is it enough?
Is it fast enough?
And is it fast enough? And nobody knows the answer to that. And we're not proposing to say that we know that this catastrophic situation is going to exist. We're only proposing that now, if in fact there's even a chance that it could exist, now would be a good time for us to start seriously planning about it. And know what we would do just in case it happened.
I ping pong between being optimistic and being the very opposite. On the optimistic side, I really don't think it's a question of if we transition to renewables and away from fossil fuels. I think we absolutely are going to, without question. The question is, are we going to do it fast enough to avoid the more catastrophic impacts of climate change? That's the question. Because the market is shifting. It isn't shifting fast enough for the planet, but it is shifting. California gets attacked for being, knee-jerk environmentalists, but they're pretty far along on renewables, and they've got a target to be 100% renewable in a couple decades. That's the world's fifth biggest economy. Things are shifting, and our political paralysis isn't necessarily permanent. It is the condition we're in now, But it may not be the condition we're in next year or 5 years from now. So I can't be totally pessimistic, but at the same time, we can't sit here and be and assume that we're going to figure it out. We can't go there either. So I think we have to do both. We have to, you know, we have to fight the current fight, but then we have to plan if those best efforts fail.
That's Martin Peterson and Stephen Binkler. Binkler is the New Orleans-based founder of Common Edge Collaborative, a nonprofit that advocates for planning and design engagement with the public. Martin C. Peterson is executive director of Common Edge and acting executive director for The Lens. We'll be back next week with more investigative reporting and informed opinion. Support our work today at thelensnoaa.org/donate. I'm Tom Wright. Thank you for getting Behind the Lens.